Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And as of this week, this show is brought to you by you. So thank you to our early patrons supporting us now each week at patreon.com/UKtech. This may come as news to some of you, but we put out a special episode on the feed a few hours ago, or late last night, depending on when you looked at your feed, to say we are now a Patreon podcast. And if you're already a patron, then this that you're hearing now in your ears is your extended cut of this week's show. And if you're not yet a patron but would like to get our extended versions and my weekly columns and various other exclusive perks that we're giving to our supporters, you can now head for the very first time to patreon.com/UKtech. That's patreon.com/UKtech to find out how you can support us. Obviously, links will be in all the usual places on at Text Message Pod on our website, techpodcast.uk. There'll be a link in this MP3 feed in the description for the file as well. So it's there, and you can obviously be prepared to hear at least a little bit of plugging of that each week. But this is all very exciting, isn't it, Ian? We're in our third year.
It is. Is it 3 years?
Well, we've done 2 complete years, and I covered some of this on the special episode, the Future of Text Message episode that we put out yesterday, which says that we did our very first tease on the 14th of January, 2015.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of interesting bits of trivia about this show that probably people don't realise. And we are rushing up on episode 100, aren't we, which is really exciting. So this will be our third year and our 100th episode. But originally, you wanted to sort of do this as a much more, have many more people involved and have guests with you each week. And it just ended up being the Ian and Nate experiment, didn't it, ultimately? We've had some good guests on as well, but I like doing it, so you are unable to prise me away from this second mic.
Well, there's a special episode on the feed right now. It's about 15 minutes or so long. If you want to go and have a listen to, you know, where we're trying to take the show, what's next, why have we moved to Patreon, why are we not moving to advertising, and the very realistic fact of just the sheer amount of time that it takes to do this show. It's anything between about 10 and 20 hours a week of my time in terms of research and prep, recording, editing, and what have you. So something's got to give at some point, and I don't want to make the show less regular. In fact, if anything, I want to make it more regular, and we want to make episodes longer and bigger and do written columns every week for people. So all that stuff is happening, but rather than accepting advertising, which we've had offers for, you know, several, and I've always turned them down, we're doing it this way instead. So for those of you who want the show to just be exactly as it is and no changes, then fine, you know, yeah, carry on listening to the free feed, or go and, you know, you can give us the equivalent of about a beer a month just to support us. That's great. But as part of that, even at the lowest level, you'll get an extended version of the show every single week with extra stories, more conversation between Ian and I, things like that, stuff that you told us in the December listener survey that you really wanted. So thank you to in fact, I'm going to list all these people here: Richard, Heather, Stephen, Michael, David, Daniel, Alison, Guy, Andrew, Tom, Joshua, Mike H, Mike M, Miles D, Matt, James, Oliver, Anthony, Leo, Brian, Graham, Marta, Richard, Tara, Kieran, David, Kate, Will, and Richard. And Carl and Tim, who pledged literally as we were recording. They have managed to pledge before we even did the first episode. So
amazing.
Thank you to all those guests. Now, one of those people might be my mother. Thanks, Mum. I won't spend it on sweets, promise. But anyway, thank you to all those people, and we'll leave that conversation there for the time being. But as I said, there's a much bigger explanation about what we're doing with the show this year, so do give that a listen on the feed. Now, I think it's time to quote Theresa May slightly, to get on with it, which is to say, the show. Ian, according to The Register, UK mobile networks are now 8% less crap according to...
I mean, that's
tests.
That's good news, isn't it? I mean, any amount of less crapness is going to be a good thing, right?
Something like that, yeah. Now, they were writing a story about mobile network performance monitor RootMetrics, which did a big study, it does this every few months, about the reliability of the UK's mobile networks and how they've improved 8% in the last 6 months of 2016, from the summer through to the end of the year. Now, this is based on network performance on roads, indoor locations, using regular people's phones, you know, just ones purchased from regular operator stores during the day, during nighttime, while walking and driving. No special equipment or anything. And they reckon one of the conclusions of this study was that 7 million additional Britons are now covered by 4G versus a year ago, which I think is very interesting and certainly something I've noticed in my own experience. I don't know if you have, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm on 3, so arguably the weakest network in some regards, especially in London. Due to oversubscription. Of course, I'm on Plusnet as well now. So I have an EE by the back door, if you will, and it's very good. And that's a SIM card that I have in my iPad. But I've actually, I met the RootMetrics people ages and ages ago and did a little, we did some testing. And it's quite interesting. Their app is quite good. You can install an app and it tells you bits about where you are and what the signal on average is like. And they showed us how they do it. They basically... I mean, won't go so far as to say nail smartphones to a plank of wood, but basically they do have quite a controlled environment that they drive around the country with and do all these tests. So it's pretty cool. But yeah, it's good. It's good, right? I mean, any improvement. I mean, you would expect things to improve. I don't like it when things get worse.
And... in terms of improvement, apparently Vodafone was the most improved, which shared the top spot with EE in Scotland and Northern Ireland, although Vodafone apparently came out worst in data performance ranking. Now, I did have a look at sort of the highlights for each of the four main networks here, EE, O2, 3, and Vodafone, to really pick out kind of one conclusion that applied to each of these. Now, EE was apparently the best for everything. RootMetrics said that while other operators had shown improvement at the UK level, compared to the first half of 2016's testing, EE's performance across all test categories were a cut above the rest. So that's overall reliability, speed of data, data performance. I'm not quite sure what the difference is between speed and data performance because they feel kind of synonymous. Call quality and reliability and texting. And EE came out the top across all of these. O2... its rankings actually remain identical. So they had a pretty flat change to the end of the year, or rather they didn't change at all into the end of the year, at least in terms of overall performance, network reliability, data performance and call performance. But apparently texting improved on O2 for the 9 people who still send text messages.
How does it even improve? What have they changed? Or what? I mean, is it just because there's no demand anymore?
Could possibly be, but I suppose that there was very little change between the start of the year and last year in terms of demands for text messages. Maybe 5 years on 5 years, but I mean, texts can sometimes fail where calls seem to work somehow. I'm not quite sure why that is, but it is a thing. 3 earned a reputation, apparently, for delivering strong network reliability results. And that was the same at the end of last year for RootMetrics.
It's reliably always the same.
Its reliability score was 92.8. Presumably that's out of 100, which means it wasn't far behind EE, which was in first place with 94.5. Yeah. So outside of London, perhaps, EE3 is a hell of a lot more reliable. And then Vodafone ranked second in categories for network speed, call performance, and text performance. It ranked third in other categories, but apparently the results were fairly strong. So it doesn't seem that any network has really failed in the last half of the year compared to the start of the year, but it does seem that across the board, 4G has really improved in these tests. And apparently, overall, we're now 8% less bad or 8% better. It depends who's writing the headline. Okay, now we... One thing we're not going to do over the next 12 months in this show is talk about every time a tech company raises its prices because of weakness in the pound. And I wasn't going to talk about Sonos raising its prices this week. But then Microsoft said it was going to raise its prices on its laptops, its Surface Book. So I thought we'd spend just a couple of minutes just on these, just to look at the sort of percentages that we're starting to see increasing here. Sonos had said, and Sonos actually is the maker of the speaker systems, the wireless things, generally pretty high end. They said on Monday that they're going to raise their prices as much as 25%, depending on the product. So the one that I looked at, because I looked into these numbers, and there's an amplifier product that they do, which will go up from 25% to £499. Some other of their products, like the Play 3 speaker, will rise 15% to £299. Now that's higher than we've seen the pound drop in some cases. The pound has dropped against the dollar about 17% so far since the referendum vote. So the Play speaker rise is actually less than the pound has fallen, but obviously that's made up for by the 25% for some other products.
And also, you've got to the way I would see it is that they're obviously they're insuring themselves against having to do another price rise in the future, where by having a little bit of headroom in there. Now, having said that, and we'll talk about Microsoft putting up its prices as well, I do have less sympathy with Sonos because I don't feel like their speakers necessarily cost what they charge for them. Like, the margin on speakers is considerable, and they also don't do a lot. Like, they don't seem to add a lot of extra stuff in. I mean, you get the occasional software update and features with Sonos, but it moves at a glacial pace anyway. But I find that price rise a little bit annoying. That feels a bit more gougy. And whereas with Microsoft and the Surface Book, we all know that PCs are, as a rule, built on very little profit anyway.
There is that, but I mean, businesses live and die on the margins that they can command, and Sonos has always been a more of a higher margin product. Plus, I believe they pay for all their components in dollars. So
They said that in their statement, actually, that they pay for everything in dollars.
So then, and the reason we're talking about this is to keep tabs on the percentages companies are changing their prices, because we know how much the pound has fallen. Therefore, we can tell whether a company is maybe taking advantage of this in some ways and maybe giving consumers an easier ride. And I actually think that for Microsoft, they're giving consumers an easier ride. It's unavoidable that the pound has fallen, and that means our money gets us less than what it did before, but it's dropped 17%. Microsoft is raising the prices of the Surface Book by 11.5%. So they're not actually increasing it as much as, I want to say, quote-unquote, could, at least in terms of having parity with the decline of the pound's value.
Yeah, I mean, they could increase it by any amount they wanted to, really, couldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, so they've increased prices about £150 across the board, according to some figures TechCrunch had posted. So a base model that used to cost £1,299 now costs £1,449. So it's £150 more, but it's just over 11% more. So not 17% more, and not the 25% more that Sonos is charging for its amplifier, which I can only assume is because they sell far fewer of them, and the Surface seems to be doing quite well. Well, if you have an opinion on the price hikes that we've seen or the percentages therein, then let us know. If there's one thing that I can honestly say we love on this program, it is an email about percentages sent to podcast@natelangson.com. Or you can join the now hundreds of people who have signed up to follow us on Twitter for our midweek UK technology news tweets and comments at TextMessagePod. I wanted to move to an email. We've got a few emails this week, so we're going to scatter them throughout the show. This one came from Mike W. Now, Mike, I believe, is one of our early patrons, so thank you very much, Mike. He says, "Hi, Nate and Ian. After listening to your show a while back regarding Virgin Media trialling their own version of Wi-Fi hotspots using routers within their customers' homes, I decided to purchase a new router and use my Virgin Media router just as a modem." He said he had the new V6 box installed yesterday and started chatting to an engineer about this whole Wi-Fi thing, which is nice. And this engineer believed that keeping the Virgin Media router in modem mode won't actually prevent Virgin Media from being able to broadcast on their own, you know, their own SSID, sorry, when they decide to roll this out to the rest of the country, if they choose to. The engineer said that it's why many of the users within 200, within the 200 megabits per second service have speed tests that hit about 220 megabits per second at the moment, because the extra bandwidth is what's going to be used for public Wi-Fi when hotspots are enabled. Now, this is really interesting, and we hadn't heard anything like that, nor did Mike say that he'd found anything on their websites or anything to confirm or deny this, but it totally makes sense, because I get higher than 200 megabits per second on my Virgin router at home, so it stands to reason that I can't have a viable complaint if that drops to exactly what I'm paying for.
And let's be honest, it wouldn't all the time anyway. I mean, like, how many of us live in a place where people are going to be wanting to use Virgin public Wi-Fi? It's very unlikely, isn't it? Unless you live in a town centre, most people passing through are not going to jump on the internet. I mean, it might happen, but it's quite unlikely.
It is unlikely, and certainly unlikely where I live, in a nature reserve where I don't have neighbours on one side and it's a private street.
Yes.
You know, it's very suspicious if somebody comes down our road and stands outside the house for a while, because why would you?
Yeah, absolutely. But if you want to prevent this, so there are two ways you can do it. First of all, you can go on the Virgin Media website and opt out. Now, I don't know if that works at the moment, because they're only trialling it, but that will stop you, I believe, having access to the Wi-Fi network, which you might think is not a problem. But I seem to remember, and I can't remember if we mentioned this in the show when we talked about it first, there's also another thing that it takes away from you. It might be tube Wi-Fi. But again, tube Wi-Fi is also free if you're on basically any of the mobile networks, and everyone is on the mobile network. So really, you probably shouldn't have to worry. When I go on it, I just use my 3 account. But if you want to stop it without them knowing, then all you have to do is just build a little Faraday cage for your home broadband, especially if you're using it in router mode. If you're using it in modem mode rather than router mode, where you're not actually using the Wi-Fi yourself, obviously you just build a little metal box for it, and then no one will be able to connect to the Wi-Fi, because it won't be getting out. But of course, I don't use my Virgin modem as my Wi-Fi hotspot. I have a router which does that, and because that thing is the Virgin modem is absolutely atrocious as a router. It is one of the worst things I've ever used.
What in life? That is literally one of the worst things you've ever used in your entire life.
It's absolutely abysmal, yeah, and it hasn't got any better either. It has progressively got worse. So anyone using them as their sole point of access is really, they're cheating themselves.
Well, let us know any other thoughts you have about Wi-Fi, and thanks very much to Mike for sending in that email, along with, of course, with his patronage. podcast@nateslangston.com, that's where you can send yours. Now, The Guardian, almost, I think, along with literally every other tech site in the world, reported that Nokia's 3310 might be about to re-slither down the resurrectory birth canal, if that is such a term, later this month.
If it is, it shouldn't be, because that's gross.
Slither down the resurrectory birth canal?
Yes.
What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that.
It's unpleasant. It's an unpleasant image.
It's evocative.
It is.
Is what it is. According to regular accurate leaker Evan Blass, says the paper, a revised 3310 will be unveiled at Mobile World Congress in Barcelona at the end of the month. Now, this is styled as an homage and will cost about £50, which really is a steal compared to the fact that in 2000, the 3310 cost £119. Now, this is a fitting story to have discovered this week, because last week we were talking about our favourite old mobile phones, mostly because I just wanted to. And then literally a couple of days after that, that's the last time I'm going to say literally this week, we saw this news that the 3310 might be getting resurrected. Now, this is great. If this turns out to be true, and all the signs are that it is, then it's going to be manufactured by HMD. Now, I forgot who HMD was, and I was talking to Andy Hoyle at CNET the other week, and I thought it was a Chinese manufacturer that bought the brand. But it's actually Foxconn that's doing the manufacture, according to Andrew. And HMD is basically the new home for the Nokia brand after it was purchased and killed by Microsoft. It was created by former Nokia employees and is based in Finland, and their goal is to keep, you know, the joy of Nokia phones alive. And it does seem that perhaps 15 years, or however long it is, 17 years, after the 3310 came out, that maybe it's time for a revival. And, you know, in this world of phone hacking and always on connections and everything, it does seem like not the worst time to launch a simple, hard as cockroach type mobile phone. What do you think, Ian?
Okay, I have two distinct thoughts about this.
Are they both negative?
No. The first thought is this is the worst thing ever to happen to the entire history of the world.
And that's that's negative.
Yes, but I said that there's two, and that's the first one. What annoyed me more about this story than the fact that the phone is coming back is the reaction to the phone coming back, because everyone sort of lost their minds about, you know, oh, this phone is coming back. This is my favourite phone. Right, I'll be honest, I never had this phone. I never saw the attraction. I think it's an ugly beast. And yes, it certainly was rugged and it certainly did last. But so did, like, Ericsson T18s and stuff like that. It's one of those things, you know, everyone's aware of this phenomenon. People talk about a TV programme. They say that, you know, Westworld is the best TV programme ever. And, you know, you haven't seen it. And you get crosser and crosser and crosser about the fact that everyone won't shut up about it until you're like, no, I've been watching it now. On principle, I just can't do it. Yeah, so that was my first reaction. And, I don't really care about the phone going back. And then I was thinking about this situation, you know, like the Donald Trump, as it is, you know, people having their phones searched at the border. And I thought, oh, well, actually, this is a phone that you could take abroad with you. You don't need to worry about anyone getting into it. There's no information that's particularly valuable on it. It's not a smartphone. You just have a nice little simple phone and it lets you text and make calls while you're abroad. And your data stays safely at home where it can't be bothered. And I, from that perspective, yeah. Or to put in your car as an emergency phone. You know, there are lots of good uses for it. I remain annoyed by the whole thing because it's not going to come back looking the same, is it? And if it does, people will be like, this is a brick. I hate it. Why have I got this? Why does it weigh this much?
And then they'll see, wow, I haven't charged it for 2 weeks. And wow, the apocalypse happened. And the only thing still surviving is cockroaches and this phone.
Yeah, but that phone might survive a nuclear apocalypse. Well, it won't because it's an electric device like any other. But it still relies on a network behind it to operate, doesn't it? It's not a magic device. It's not a flipping walkie-talkie.
Anyway, this is going to be hopefully coming out at Mobile World Congress. That's at the end of this month.
Hopefully. The most massive air quotes in the world I've just done.
Let us know any thoughts you have on anything so far we've discussed, podcast@natelangson.com, or suggest stories for us at textmessagepod. That's where we are increasingly keeping our eyes. And one thing that came out of neither of those channels this week was the news that, Ian, can you pronounce the name of this Irish mobile network, please?
Well, I think it's probably Air.
Air or Ear?
It's more likely to be Air, isn't it? I mean, no one's going to name a network Ear.
Ire, yeah.
It's obviously derived from the name of the Irish name for Ireland, which is, depending on who you believe online, either Air or Airy or Airy or something like that. If you're Irish, please let us know and try not to mock too much that our inability to pronounce your country name.
True. And I wanted to talk about this because as part of my push to reach into more corners of the United Kingdom, I've been following and subscribing and reading a hell of a lot more news about Ireland, Wales and Scotland in order to make sure that any big tech stories that happen in those countries are being represented better on the show. And I saw this week and I thought it was really interesting that this network will be the first to launch Wi-Fi calling, which is obviously the technology that allows people to use their Wi-Fi networks at home or abroad to make calls when they're out of signal. It is the first Irish network, according to the Irish Times, to do this. And Sinead Morrissey, who is the head of products for the network, said there's no need for downloadable client. It's all integrated into the device. So this is a nod that they're not doing what Three used to do, which is make you download a separate app. They're using the hardware-based, for want of a better description, Wi-Fi call, which is great. Now, this will only launch on the Galaxy S6 and S7 first. And Morrissey said that Samsung's the largest proportion of their user base, so they wanted to start with a range of devices that would give them the most reach across that base. But specifically, no iOS devices, which I find a little bit disappointing. But it's a good sign that it's not just our big networks in mainland England that are jumping into the Wi-Fi calling space. This is extending out into the other regions too, which I think is great. That's going to be available for people who pay on a bill from the end of this month, early March, which is great. And I'm using that as a bit of a segue as well to talk about a couple of emails we had this week that stemmed from previous calls that we had about Wi-Fi calling. Apparently, when you talk about Wi-Fi calling, it gets a reaction out of people. A lot of people have very positive and negative experiences, depending on who you ask about this. And Andy wrote in and says, "Chaps, great stuff as always. Just two quick things. Although I have to say, the second quick thing we aren't going to have time for today. So this is just one quick things. On EE, at least, for Wi-Fi calling to work on almost all Android phones, you need a handset that was supplied by them and that has their Android on it. Andy says, my Galaxy S6 came unlocked from another retailer and so won't support Wi-Fi calling, which he says is very annoying. A clipped text he provided from EE's website says Wi-Fi calling is available in all versions of the iPhone 5C and later models of iPhone, as well as a whole bunch of these Galaxies and even the BlackBerry Priv. Now, that is a slap in the face, isn't it? That the Priv gets to use it, that we're, you know, all of its 9 users.
And the DTEC 50.
Yeah. It's only available on the EE version of all other compatible Android and Windows devices when directly bought from us. Now, there are probably very good technical reasons for this, but as a customer user experience, from my point of view, that's Nate speaking, not Andy, this is really bad. And I've looked at this, and it's the same on Vodafone, which, you know, you have to have the compatible device, but it says for Galaxies, for example, they have to be bought directly from Vodafone at one of our stores online or by phone through our customer services team. So again, you have to be buying it directly from them. Now, I thought that was very, very frustrating. Then we also had another email come in from Richard on exactly the same, well, related topic. It says, hi, Nate, just listen to your latest podcast on Wi-Fi calling. You mentioned Vodafone has it, and I just wanted to point out that they limit it. As an iPhone 6 user, they've decided that I should not get Wi-Fi calling, even with a poor signal at home. For about a year, they've been saying my phone is not capable of Wi-Fi calling, despite me pointing out that EE supports it, as does 3, or that they have a limited rollout to test it. And he wonders, surely they've tested by now. He says he has a more cynical view that they're trying to force him to upgrade when in actual fact what I'm doing is going to leave their network. I personally decided to wait to upgrade until I see what the 10th anniversary iPhone looks like. And he asks, as a matter of interest, is it usual for Wi-Fi calling not to work when you are abroad? And the answer is no. You should be able to use it when you're abroad. That's one of the points, is that it uses Wi-Fi. It should not be regionally locked. But it's interesting just how much confusion there is over what should be such a simple piece of technology, Wi-Fi calling, Ian.
Well, I on that point about using it abroad, I seem to remember when they launched things like femtocells. You couldn't just take the femtocell away with you and plug it in when you were abroad, because they didn't want you to be able to do that, because obviously what you're doing is skirting the roaming payment. So I wondered if, well, I suppose on Wi-Fi calling, they're billing you the same amount as they would if you were making a normal call. So it probably doesn't matter to them if you're using it when you're abroad, because they're still getting the same amount of revenue, which is a bit of a cheek because you're basically providing their network to them. But anyway, yeah. But yeah, it's confusing and it's stupid, and it's another one of these things that doesn't need to be. It's a relatively straightforward process. If your phone supports it, then it should support it, especially when, because you can, every phone downloads profiles from the network, doesn't it, when you go online. So yeah, it's over things like voicemail numbers and stuff like that. It's usually done for a text message that sets up the phone for WAP and things like that. So it wouldn't be too difficult, surely, for them to offer a service whereby, you know, it gets a profile that's appropriate for the network. I don't know. Maybe there's some issue with, like, people abusing it somehow that we don't know about, that they haven't told us. But that just means it's bad customer service. It's, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. I can't see any reason for it. Therefore, it's bad.
I'm going to find the answer to this.
Good.
I'm going to look into this like Sherlock Holmes, Sherlock Nate, working from Holmes. Let's finish up with a quick bite here. Apparently Google's releasing a version of the Pixel and Pixel XL called Really Blue, and it's coming to the UK. Ian, just on a show of virtual hands, how excited do you get when companies release region-specific blue versions of things?
Well, I get quite annoyed when they don't release all of the versions in all of the regions, because I find it, like, I find, and I I don't want to be too critical of Google, but I do find that Google is one of those ones where they seem absolutely 100% focused on America, and anyone that gets anything else is just lucky. Like, we don't have Google Home, we don't have the Google Wi-Fi routers, stuff like that. So for me, I was sort of... But I swear when they launched the Pixel in the UK and the US at the same time, I'm sure they said it was never coming to the UK. But it is now, which is good because apparently it is quite nice.
Well, Google says the phone's going to come to stores on the 24th of February. So that's what, next week, end of the week. And according to Engadget, if you miss the pre-order blast, there's hyperbole for you, then there's still a chance of picking one up in store. Well, finishing us up, we're going to talk about Amazon's voice assistant. I'm not going to say the name of the product just to prevent all of your devices from lighting up. Amazon's voice assistant product will, in fact, we can say Echo, it is going to get a whole new bunch of words it can say, all in the US market. But I thought this is interesting that they've picked out a bunch of quote-unquote English terms or Britishisms that it will be able to say. Now, Ian, I want you to give me a rate out of 10, 10 being the most common these words are used, to 1, as to how much these words are used in Britain. Okay. Coup.
What, as in to take over the government?
No, not coup as in coup. Coup as in COO.
Coup d'etat,
and not chief operating officer, which I assume is not what it means either.
Well, I mean, that I can only go by what I say, but zero. I mean, I don't say that. Yeah, go on.
Cheer up.
Maybe a 4.
Nah, that's more like 7.
You reckon?
I've said it like 4 times today to the cat.
Well, first of all, I need to explain something to you about cats. And second of all, what?
All right, good grief.
Oh, I say that all the time.
Yeah.
That and good heavens, that's a 9.
Good heavens, that's an older word, slightly older person's word. I don't think young people say good grief
How
as much.
How dare you? Yes.
They say WTF and OMG and...
Yeah, but I've got kids, so really I'm just, you know, good grief is a nice way of expressing, you know, something without
grief.
Ruining the children.
Okay. Cheerio.
I mean, that's very British. I mean, I don't think it gets said a lot, but it's certainly... let's go for a 6.
No, that is a 10, surely.
Because people don't actually say cheerio, do they?
Yes.
Well, I know you're going to now finish this very episode of this podcast with cheerio.
Yeah, or ta-ta, which ta-ta, is another one. Yeah, that's a northernism.
My dad says that, and he's Welsh, so, I mean, he doesn't say it a lot, but yeah. I don't think that's a very common word, so let's go for a 5.
Yeah. Righto. Much more popular pre-1920, I think.
Yeah, I don't think people really say that. 3.
Righto. Etc.
Not even sure.
And then finally, whoops-a-daisy.
Yeah, I mean, I say whoops-a-daisy quite a bit. But only because it's hilarious.
Yes, it is, isn't it? I'd opt for a 5 out of 10.
Yeah.
I mean, The Guardian postulates that these words were culled straight from Mary Poppins, which makes sense.
I can see the film Notting Hill. For whoopsie daisy has quite a famous bit in it, doesn't it, when he says whoopsie daisy and she says to him, what did you actually just say that?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, I think that's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you ever so much to everyone who has got in on our early Patreon supporting mission so far. You can join us at patreon.com/uktech, and across the pond, where Tom Merritt is also supported by Patreon, he covers the world of global tech news. Tom, what's been going on in global tech with you this week?
Hey, thanks, Nate. This week on Daily Tech News Show, we talk about cutting the cord with Veronica Belmont, whether downloadable content for video games is a ripoff or a way to get more good game content, explore a way to give a passcode that wipes your data to protect your phone at border crossings, and whether that's a good idea or not, evaluate leaks of the next iPhone and whether it will spike Apple's sales, and we find out the next big cyber attack wave coming after ransomware when David Spark reports from the RSA conference. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com. Back to you guys.
That's it, Ian.
Thanks.
We're done.
Sounds good. Cheerio.
It's been good. Cheerio, ta-ta. And please, if you haven't already, go to patreon.com/UKTech, where you can get hold of our extended cuts of this show, weekly columns written by myself and possibly Ian, who knows, we haven't actually discussed that yet, and a whole bunch of other stuff just waiting for you there. patreon.com/UKTech. Ian, it's been a pleasure. I look forward to verbally embracing you again next week.
And it shall happen.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.